guys, today we are going to attempt to, and I say that very loosely, do a summary of the Old Testament. Now, I have realized, I was going to break this down into 3 weeks, and I have realized that I don't think I can do that. It is just not how I study, and I have worried myself sick this week trying to come up with a way to knock 39 books of the Bible down into a 30-minute time period and still have it be meaningful. And so I don't think I'm going to do this for the next 2 weeks. We'll come up with a devotion or whatever, but I'm going to give you an attempt at something, because once I've started, I really, man, I just love it. It's been so long since we've been in Genesis and that time period. So what I have done is I've got a little display up on the thing. Kind of shows you a timeline, early Bible, and I want to hit a few things like who wrote Genesis and the five books of the Torah. And Moses is who is believed to have written that. So it's before they went into the Promised Land, probably that 40-year time period he had, wandering around, you know, with not a whole lot else to do. After he'd been up on Sinai and talked to God and all this, and so God gives him to say, this is how it went. So this is going to be a whirlwind, okay? So just grab something and hold on, because it's not what you would normally get from me. But, you know, when I started teaching, the first thing I said was all of us had learned children's stories. We learned about Noah. We learned about Job. We learned about all these little one-story things. And so we went in really in-depth and did book by book and chapter by chapter. But, you know, even by doing that, you've got 66 books of the Bible. And if you take it book by book, and don't take it as a whole, you've missed the point too, because it's 66 separate books, but they're all part of one whole. And to start this off, I want to let you realize that this is not a history of, you know, this book is not a history of the world. It's just not. It's not how it was designed. I mean, when they talk about creation, it's not a science book that says this is how you know, everything was formed. It's not meant to be. This is meant to be a telling of God's holy plan for mankind. Okay, starts off and builds the world and does creation, and then God was planning on having man go forward with what he was doing and live in the Garden of Eden, and all of the things would be provided for him. He was going to have this glorious thing. Well, what happened? Man fell. Well, you know, haven't we all? You know, we blame it on Adam, or we blame it on Eve, because, you know, Adam blamed it on Eve. She's the one that gave it to me, God. You know, you gave me her, and she did this. And so he blames it. But it's what happens after that. Now, God could have said, wow, man, I really messed up. He just kind of, you know, wipes the slate clean and says, I messed up. I'm just going to throw all these whole people away. But God didn't do that. What did God do? He had grace. He decided that we were going to be able to move forward. And so what we're going to try to do is look at God's plan for the redemption of fallen man, to look at the big picture, not the history of man. And because a lot of this stuff skips time. You know, when you've got Joseph in Egypt, and then the Egyptian, they're there with the Egyptians, all the Israelite people, what happened in that 400 years that was there? Do we hear about that? No. Next thing you know, some Pharaoh didn't like them, and they're enslaved, and they're helping build the pyramids. A lot of stuff happened during that time period, but God's Word doesn't tell us about all that. You know, so that wasn't part of a major part of God's holy plan. So what this book tells us is God's plan for us and for man. God says that when we obey, then He's going to deliver. Adam disobeyed, and we are covered in sin. Increasing sin in the world, separation from God, created a sinful world. God brings judgment in the way of the flood. Let's not go that far. So, if I remember. I've got way too many notes, and I'm one. In Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Okay, that's the first verse of the Bible, right? And I know I do this to you guys often, and it's not to shake your faith, but it's to allow you opportunities to grow. What the original Hebrew says, and I don't read Hebrew, but I went back today and looked at it. and I looked at the Hebrew. And what it says in the Hebrew Bible is, in the beginning, A-Z God.
A-Z.
The first letter of the Hebrew alphabet and the last letter, which is A-L-E-F, Aleph, and Tav. Those are the two. And so if I say to you, in the beginning, the Alpha and the Omega God, does that make any difference to you? Oh, Alpha and Omega, you heard that from the Greek, right? That's the beginning and the last of the Greek. If you were to translate it from the Greek and translate it into English, it would be the A-Z God. And you would see that connection with Revelation, with all the times God has said, I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. So this tells you who created the heavens and the earth. It was Jesus. It's the beginning and the end. It's the Alpha and the Omega. But the English translators looked at that and went, I'm not sure why that says A-Z. And so they left that part out. Which is understandable. I mean, and we still read it. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And He did. But it was God, Jesus. Let me see if I've got that. In John 1:1-3, in the beginning was the Word, Jesus, and the Word was God, and the Word was God, and he was with God in the beginning. Through Him all things were made. Without Him nothing was made that has been made. He is the image, in Colossians 1:15-18, He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. By Him all things were created. Things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones of powers or rulers or authorities, all things were created by Him and for Him. He is before all things, and in Him all things hold together. And He is the head of the body, the church, and He is the beginning of the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything He might have the supremacy. How could the book of creation not be filled with Jesus when He is the instrument of creation and the reason for creation? We did this before, and I showed you, I'm going to get to you. We did the Scarlet Thread of Redemption where we talked about Jesus, and they're called Christophanies or Theophanies, where you see the pre-incarnate Christ in the Old Testament before He is born in flesh in the New Testament. And I'd like to say to you that He is all over the Bible in the Old Testament. We've seen types and shadows of that, and we've seen in-person visions of Christ. Go ahead.
Oh, I agree. We've seen Christ throughout the Old Testament. I agree. But I think it's interesting, first of all, if you said A-Z God or Alpha Omega God or whatever, or just God, to me it's all the same. You just said God.
God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit.
But you just said God to me. But Moses wrote it. Moses wouldn't have known about Jesus. He wouldn't have been able to have the intention to say, this is God, it's also Jesus, this is the 3-in-1. Right? He would have not known that. I think he would have just been saying, the big God. I think that's interesting.
Okay. That is interesting.
I couldn't have written it with Jesus in mind.
Well, I'm going to throw out a bunch more to you. But that's a good process. Anyone else?
Great.
You're thinking about it.
Yeah, I'm going to take in what y'all say.
Okay. for a minute.
I have nothing for that. I mean,
well, for a minute anyway. Yeah. And what I'm really getting at is that once, through one man, Adam, sin entered the world. Through one man, we see that that the whole world is redeemed through Christ Jesus, right? Now, in between all that time, God works with individual people and then starts working with peoples, okay? So He calls out Noah, right? Now, man, we have just jumped into, like, what, chapter 13 or something of Genesis at this point. So we've gone past Cain and Abel and all that kind of stuff where God looks down upon the earth and all He sees is sin and destruction and mayhem, and He says, what am I going to do? And He calls one faithful man, and that faithful man is Noah. Now we look at the ark, and the ark is a picture of Christ, right? Because the ark, we said this before, there's one door that leads into salvation. The ark is salvation. When you are in the ark, you are saved. If you are out of the ark, you are unsaved. And so it's a type of Christ. But I also want to tell you that Noah is a type of Christ because he was a faithful, obedient servant of God who did what God had asked him to do. And he was the only one. And in so doing, he saved a multitude of people. Now, why did God save Noah? God saved Noah because he had made a promise that through the seed of the woman, the head of the serpent would be crushed. You remember back in Genesis 3. And so he is going to keep that. I mean, he's going to keep that seed going through. And that's what he does, even though the Israelite people keep falling over and over again. He has said, I'm going to be faithful to this covenant that I've made to Abraham, and, you know, which is a little bit later on coming up, but that, you know, the Redeemer, the Messiah, is going to come through your lineage through you, all these people. So, God, we're looking at this myopically. You know, how does this affect my life? Why did this plane go down? Why did somebody die? Why does this? We look at these things just, how does this affect me? And God is looking at a much bigger, broader picture over a long period of time. And he is, if you look at all of these things, you see Noah, a single man that God dealt with. You see Abraham, a single man that God dealt with. You see Moses being called, a single man that God, a type of Christ, called a faithful man and says, you are going to be a leader to lead these people out of bondage and into freedom, out of slavery, just like Christ calls us out of the slavery of sin and into the freedom to be with God. But when are they at their most distressful? When they are separated from God. So if you're faithful to God, you'll be delivered. You'll be ransomed out. You'll be brought into the glory of God. But if you're not, you're not going to be brought into the glory of God. You're going to be in distress. You're going to be in sin. Man, this is depressing, huh? Okay. But that's my synopsis here is that God deals with faithful people and delivers faithful people. So then he calls the Israelite people as a nation to come forward. After Abraham, we've just hit Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Esau, and all of those people, right? We just kind of skimmed right over them. Let me make sure I've gotten past this. I did. I've got way too many notes. Okay, and then in Genesis 11, you've got the Tower of Babel, and all the people decided God told them to all separate and go all around the world, and they didn't, and so they tried to do the Tower of Babel because of that, God dispersed them. And then you've got in Genesis 12, you start the patriarchal period, and that's when Abram is called, who will then be called Abraham at one point. And God brings him down to what portion of land? Down into Jerusalem, that general area. Why there? Why did God call him to come into that particular part of the world?
We know in Ezekiel that God looked at that as his favorite part of the world, because when the Christ is going to be born there. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's the whole area of the whole, what it's all about is that area.
And those are the lands that he's going to give them.
And geographically, everything, all the trade routes for all the Mediterranean revolve right around here. And when God decides he's going to have his people be in this pivotal point, every nation, every race is going to come through this area. And if the Israelites do what God has told them to do, they're going to tell all of these people that come to him about God, about the one true God. And they don't. And when they don't, and they don't live up to the promise that God has called them to do, then the gospel is originated right here in this. And so, like a spoke on a wheel, everything branches out from that. All the diaspora, when they are persecuted and they're sent out, and all the Christians are going out, that allows the gospel to be spread to the entire world. So, I'm going to skip now to Joseph. We just went from... See why I had such a hard time with this? Because it's just, you can't really get into anything very deep. So Joseph is sold into slavery. He goes into Egypt. God positions one man through his suffering, his persecution, his rejection, to become the second most influential person in Egypt who brings salvation to the whole known world during a great famine because of his faithfulness to God. But we are looking to a greater Savior than Joseph that is going to come. So Joseph is also a picture of Christ, a type of Christ that he, through his faithfulness and honesty and turning away from, the lust of the wife and all the different things that happened to him and not turning his back on God but being faithful to God is brought out. Well, then 400 years go by and the Israelites that are there are now perceived as a threat. And so God had, and they've been there for 400 years, so what do you become? Just like the Babylonians, you become an Egyptian, more or less. I mean, they're slaves of the Egyptians, but he has to figure out some, or God didn't have to figure out a way, but God had to let them see that they wanted to be saved from where they are. They wanted to be brought out and brought into a renewal. So Pharaoh enslaves the people of Israel after they are brought, after they had been there for 400 years. The people cry out to God in their oppression, and God raises up a deliverer, Moses. His birth, his upbringing, his education. There are a lot of parallels with Christ. He leads the people out of bondage, just like Jesus will lead us out of bondage. Pharaoh hardens his heart for the first six plagues, and then God hardens his heart for the next six plagues. You remember what the plagues represented?
The gods of Egypt.
The gods of Egypt. Why? They weren't just things to make Pharaoh say, hey, I got to turn these people loose. What God was doing, and he was showing the people, he started with the sun god, and he defeated the sun god. You remember the what was it, the frogs, the locusts, all of these were gods that the Egyptians worshipped. And because of this, God took them one at a time and took them off the scale and got rid of them. In order to,
thank you for doing this. Because I suggested when I got to leave, we're doing music today.
No problem. So, okay. But so he is not going to be able to. Wait a minute. So Pharaoh has hardened his heart, and he takes down these plagues one at a time, and because they represent the Egyptian gods, and he wanted to show to the people that he was the one true God. And they've been living with the Egyptians all this time. God needed to bring the people back to him and retrain their thinking, get them out of the Egyptian mindset. And with that, you have the Passover, which is very symbolic of Christ. And then you go into the wilderness, and they go across the Red Sea into Mount Sinai. Then you have the golden calf, the spies in the Promised Land, the disobedience that brings the consequences of that. And so God allows that generation to pass away, and he resets the clock again. God continuously says, you're going to disobey, you're going to go the wrong way, but I'm going to keep you in the promise. There's some way that I'm going to make the promise work. And so that's what he's doing. And this time he resets it with a brand new generation. And that generation is faithful to God. They cross over the Jordan River, symbolic of being brought out of bondage in the Red Sea. So they walk into the promised land, and they're great. They defeat the people of Jericho, right? The walls come tumbling down. Everything's looking good because they're doing exact. God says, walk around this thing seven times and blow your trumpets. And you know they had to be going, what the hell is this all about? Why would I be doing that? But they did what God asked them to do, and the walls came tumbling down. The next thing they did, they went to where? Ai. You remember that? And they decided they were going to do it on their own. What happened to them? Defeated. I mean, just a butt whipping. They just took, they just did not do very well at all. Why? They didn't do what God asked them to do. They were against what God had asked them to do. So when you walk, this is the hardest part we can't get. This is the whole key to everything. You're in the Garden of Eden. You're Adam. God has given you everything. And you walk away from God and say, I can do it on my own. And don't look at me like that. It wasn't Adam. It's us. We all do it. I can do this on my own. And when you do, you fail. And when you trust in God and are faithful to him, you succeed. But every time we succeed, we think we did it. I know I do. I think it's because I worked harder, or I did more, or I prayed more, or I... And it's not me. It's God. When I walk with God and I'm faithful to him, things work out right. When I don't... Well, I'm just going to give you a different picture just so we can switch that off. I just like this one, too. It kind of talks about the Old Testament timeline, call of Abraham, the Exodus, the entrance into Canaan, conquest completed. Then you're going to go into the period of the Judges. I really liked this one. Let me see if I can find this. Where Jesus, where we were talking about being out in the wilderness, Jesus compares himself to the manna from heaven. I mean, I've got one whole tablet I'm not going to bring out that talks about all the Christophanies where you see Christ in the Old Testament. Really, really, it's not all of them anyway, because first of all, ones I looked at, I went, they're missing about three. I mean, just in Genesis, because we've done this before, and it's a lot of fun, but it wasn't exhaustive. But in John 6, 32 through 35, Jesus said to them, talking about the manna, I tell you the truth, it is not Moses who has given you bread from heaven, but it is my Father who gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. Sir, they said, from now on, give us this bread. Then Jesus declared, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never go hungry, and who believes in me will never be thirsty. And anyway, so that's just another Christophany. I'm trying to, I've totally lost most of my, let's go off of this one. Israel's monarchy begins, and you remember, how long were they a unified country? Remember, David brought them into a unified country. It lasted about three generations. By the time you get to Solomon, 120 years or so, then his children had, you know, one went north, one went south, and you've got Judah, and you've got the northern kingdom. Soon the northern kingdom fades away, and you still got Judah for a little bit longer, and then Judah goes off into captivity. And then during that time period, boy, is this a quick version of the Old Testament or what? You've got the division of the kingdom, the periods of the kings, and during all this, you can see that Samuel 8, Samuel, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, Kings, Chronicles, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Isaiah, all of these are during the period of the kings. And then right here before the fall of the southern kingdom, you had Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel. And then during that Babylonian exile is when Daniel, we talked about, was in Babylon. And when he writes his basically apocalyptic revelations that God had given him. And then when they come out, you've got the post-exilic, which is Zechariah, Haggai, Malachi, Ezra, Nehemiah. Ezra talking about the rebuilding of the temple and so forth. And now, 15 years of teaching has just been brought down to about 20 minutes. Are y'all happy about that? I'm not. But if anybody would like to look at my notes, I probably have got about 10 or 15 pages of notes.
And it is repetitive, though.
It's extremely repetitive.
It's God saying, don't turn away from me, and they do. Don't turn away from me, and they do.
And God is in a place that he says, no matter what, I'm going to show you that I'm not just a God of punishment, like the flood. Let's go back to the flood. He is a God of justice. So he killed the entire world, except for he's a God of mercy, and he allowed the one who is faithful to live, which was Noah, and then reset. And he does the same thing to Israel over and over again. Why did the southern kingdom last longer than the northern kingdom? They had a couple of good kings. Remember? Oh, they tore their clothes, and we found the book of the law, and they have a revival. And all of a sudden, the people all turn back towards God, and they get rid of their idols, and everything's great. And then they fall back away again. And so eventually God says, okay, we need another reset, and boom, off they go into Babylon. And
I wonder if he was intending to send Jesus. Jesus is the part of God all along, or he kept thinking he could take care of it.
Yeah.
Person take care of it, I won't have to go down there. And finally, at the end, he's like, I gotta go down there and do this myself.
Jesus was in the plan from day one.
From what?
I'm just gonna say, Genesis 1:1, Jesus was in the plan.
But it just feels like he was trying to get it done with these other people, these other.
He's showing to us, and this is being very egocentric and self-centric on our part. I think he was showing to us and all the people that have lived before us, can y'all not see this? Can you not see how I want you to walk with me and walk in the light and not in the darkness? I mean, I could go through all the different versions. I went off on a rabbit hole for that on light and darkness and the Son of God and the S-U-N of God and just on and on. It's an enlightening that we tend to have our eyes blacked out to at times when we think, I can do this on my own. And why should I have God telling me what to do when I can do this on my own? Why should I not eat from that tree of the knowledge of good and evil when I could?
So I got a question. I agree with you, but I hear a lot of people say, so if he's
all-knowing. He knew he had Christ up from the beginning. Why did he let all that happen?
Why not?
Just plain.
I mean,
that's what I'm saying. That's what people will say. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I agree that I think we don't learn unless we see a history. You know, we have to see, we have to learn from those that have gone before. We have to know for ourselves. And then give us free will. And in that is this. Right. But I hear a lot of people go, well, why would you throw that? Why wouldn't you just say?
Well, why wouldn't he just say, I'm going to wind you up and turn you loose and you're going to do exactly what I say. And so therefore you have no free will. And it's not really up to you. I've got the control over all this. I mean, I think he allows us that freedom to go or not to go. And in that freedom is not that we have so much power or self-control or will or whatever. It's that we realize we can't do this without him. And when we try to do this without him, then that's where the problem comes. And we've all done it. I mean, we've all slipped off one side or the other and realized I can't do this without God. And yet, when times are good, it's really easy to walk that way. You know, it's when things are bad, when things do go bad, that we kind of wake up and go, whoa, why am I off the road? Why am I down in this rut someplace? Because we don't realize the goodness of God.
You know, I'm a parent, you know, and the more years I parent, the more I get this, is that, you know, I try to tell my kids all the time, that I'm going to love you no matter what. But for your choices, you can make a good choice, you make a bad choice. You get behind the wheel if you're having a drink, or you get behind, inside the car with somebody spending money. And I will love you while you sit there in jail. But I was to love you. But it was your choice, you know. And I taught you better, so you.
And there are consequences to the choice. I think that's what God teaches us. There are consequences to the actions that you take, and that's the hard thing for us. Well, why would God allow that to happen? Well, because there are consequences to the decisions that you make, not only to yourself but to others. But there are good consequences to the decisions. If Noah hadn't followed God, his family wouldn't have been saved. You see, so you can influence a multitude of people through the decisions that you make. It's not just you making a decision. It's you're making a decision that's going to influence a lot of other people. And I think there's a magic to walking with God, if you want to call it that. There's a magic. There's a majesty. But that realization doesn't seem real to us, that it really does happen. And all of us have been on those mountaintop experiences from time to time when we get that little glimpse behind the curtain and realize the true majesty of God. But we just, for some reason, just like the Israelites, can't stay there. We just can't stay there. It's too hard in this world to stay there with your eyes focused on God.
Something interesting I found in Romans 8:20. It says, for the creation of man was subjected to vanity or sin, not willingly, but because of him or God who subjected it in hope. So, but without sin, sin was part of God's plan all along, according to this verse here.
Well, I can...
Because he put us in the flesh.
I can see that.
Yeah. Without sin, like I said before, without sin, there could be no redemption from sin.
Right.
What are you redeemed from?
Right. There's no relationship.
Yeah.
Well, we just started to armor God. Priscilla Schreier, she was talking about how in the beginning he already had, you know, a plan, but there are the Holy of Holies of angels that are there, you know, and they're here. And then there's us, and there's a reason we're at the bottom of the rung, so we are constantly working towards relationship. And there's a reason we're kind of not oblivious, but don't always make it, you know, because we're constantly searching, you know. And with that, it is magical, it is holy, it is, you know.
I kind of look at the Old Testament another way. I don't know if this is true or not, but I kind of think that he was preparing the people for the Son of God to come on the earth and to walk to show who God is, what he was really about. I kind of look at it like, well, you got the Old Testament, everybody's sinning, and you got this happened through God, and what God did to this nation, because he did it his way, and when Jesus was born, he finally seen the Son of God and the image of God walking on earth and what it's really about. And people didn't know how to take that. You know, they didn't understand, well, who is this king come on earth? He's, you know, who is this person doing all these miracles and doing this and that and that and that and other, you know. And finally, when they crucified him, they figured out, well, that was some image of God himself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, well, they woke us up, you know.
And that sums it up.
You know, that's pretty much how you look at it. Like, we woke up, this is the Son of God. Now we know who God really is.
Yep.
You know?
Anyone else?
So,
I can't find it in 1 Corinthians, but there's a place in 1 Corinthians that talks about the Old Testament is an example for us today. We are to study it, though we don't take it literally. It's a shadow. It's a shade of the very image, which is spiritual, according to Hebrews 5. Right. So I can't find it.
And you see that over and over again, where you know, Jesus said, I didn't come to change a dot or a tittle. I mean, what the Old Testament has said is a foreshadowing of what is to come with him. And he has come. I mean, I could never find it in here, but I've got some different quotes from different places in the New Testament. I know it's none of these first ones, where Jesus is talking about that exact same thing. Oh, man. I want to ask you this question. So, because I thought this was really cool. You know, God left the temple when the temple was destroyed, when they went off to Babylon. When is the next time that God enters the temple? Don't say Revelation. Don't say Millennium. When's the next time that God walks into the temple?
Money changers. Go Jesus.
Well, you're close. When a 12-year-old boy walks into the temple is when God re-entered the temple. Isn't that cool? Doesn't that just give you chill bumps? 12-year-old boy walks back into the temple and God has re-entered the temple in Jerusalem.
What did 12-year-old boy do?
It was Jesus when he came back into the temple. And he got lost there for a couple of days. And can you imagine? You know, it's just... We're in a big caravan, and where is he? You know,
imagine the mama's heart.
Oh, and
where have you been? Well, where else would I be?
And how far can I go back? And yeah, he's not upset. Where else can I go? Yeah.
He read half Isaiah and stopped because it's talking about him.
Yeah. Oh, it is so cool.
Did you say that Jesus, when he walked in, was so bad doing in the temple, and then when he got older, he went back in the temple and did his thing. So, all these things going on. So, yeah.
But can't you imagine how he was thinking? I'm coming back.
You want to go through his head when he walked in his house.
What's going on?
Yeah, it's really cool. It is really cool. And we could go on and on, and I've got one description of all these different things where it talks about the Christophanies, but like I said, it's not very complete, so I'm not going to throw it out there. So any other questions or comments? I apologize for not stretching this out for 3 whole weeks, but I just, in doing this study, it just kind of threw me off because I'm not used to doing such a quick little overview.
I think you should loop back to the very first lesson where we determined that there are dinosaurs in the Bible. Because that was the beginning question. The beginning lesson of it all was, where are the dinosaurs in the Bible?
I already said, where are the dinosaurs?
I'm going down, everybody would ask me. It was convoluted. We had to figure out what the minotaurs or whatever were, and we kind of...
It's been a while.
But back here with the creatures.
But yeah. Best I remember, Genesis 1 and 3 are both a repeat of the creation story. They're two different creation stories. But we could definitely go back and do all the way to Genesis and come back through again. I think it would be fun the second time. But we've still got to do the New Testament first. So. Or as Mr. Wayne said, go straight to Revelation. So. It takes a while. It does take a while. But I think it's been a good journey. I mean,
sure, it's good to get up late. And when he read it's, oh man! I asked for this.
Yeah, well, that's all right. And it wasn't that great, but I thought that was the best way that I could do it. It was to show how God had worked through one person, and then through one family, and then through one nation to bring about these things. He kept branching out and including more and more people. But you remember when he had Saul? And Saul was this great, handsome, you know, model-looking guy, perfect king, really tall, does all that kind of stuff. And then he doesn't work out so well. He's most likely to succeed, but then he doesn't really succeed. And so Samuel goes and picks out, you know, David, basically. And David's this little scrawny runt who, you know, is least likely to succeed. But God says, I'm looking at the inside, not the outside. I'm not looking for the strong. I'm looking for the strong spiritually, for the one after my own heart. And just changes everything around so that we look at things differently. But we still don't. We still look at the outward appearance and not the inward appearance, and how strong someone can be spiritually and how beautiful that can be. So, man, we could do this all day, but we're going to turn it over. Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you.